Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
WNYC is supported by Signature Theater, presenting Lynn Nottage's By the Way, Meet Vera Stark, directed by Camilla Forbes, following a black actress who gets her big break playing a slave during the golden age of Hollywood. SignatureTheater.org. Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, offering innovative cancer treatment, including immunotherapy and minimally invasive surgery. MSK is working to find new ways to customize cancer care. Memorial Sloan Kettering, more science, less fear. WNYC's health coverage is supported by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, bridging science and the arts by supporting documentary films such as American Experience's Sea Lab, about scientists living and working on the sea floor, on PBS February 5th. More at sloan.org.
When Wilson met his first grade teacher, she asked him an innocent question.
What'd you do this summer?
But Wilson didn't have an easy answer because last summer, he'd been separated from his mom at the border.
Well, I am glad you're here.
Life after family separation. Next time on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Tonight at 8 on 93.9 FM WNYC.
You're listening to All of It with Allison Stewart on WNYC. Cuba Gooding Jr. became a household name on the back of scene-stealing performances in Boys in the Hood, The Tuskegee Airmen, and of course his Oscar-winning turn in Jerry Maguire. More recently, he was nominated for an Emmy for his starring role in the FX series The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Cuba directed a film called Bayou Caviar last fall and returned to Broadway, reprising the role of Billy Flynn in the musical Chicago. His final bow as Billy Flynn is on February 10th, this coming Sunday. He came by the studio last fall for a chat about his career, and in honor of his final bow, here's our conversation.
What made you want to get behind the camera? You have been an actor for a long time, all kinds of roles, but now you're going to be a director.
Yeah, I was afraid for years to ever consider directing. And then had a conversation with Denzel Washington when he had done his first directorial effort. And he said, direct and you'll understand why. And I get it now. And I think it's, you know, as an actor, you step on a set with a lot of times with first-time directors even, and you surrender your performance to them, and then you leave, and you know, months later, sometimes a year later, you see the work and you realize that they didn't really get it, you know. But as a director, you go into that editing room and you have all the takes to choose from your performance and all the co-stars' performance. So that part of the process is really intoxicating. And because I wrote with the original writer this screenplay, it really opened up the act of discovery for all the characters for me. You know, I really visualized the movie. So when I got on the set, I think the other most important job for a director is to answer questions. Uh-huh. Everybody's got questions. Wardrobe lady to the director of photography, everybody has questions. If you don't have answers, that breeds insecurity, and then that can, you know, affect the energy of a set. So, mm-hmm. you know, having written with the original writer, I had all the answers, you know, and it just informed me as a director. And I tell you, I'd rather direct than act right now.
That's really?
Yeah, it's that engaging.
Edit rooms are the best place.
Oh, yeah.
Edit rooms were where the magic happens.
That's right.
As you're sitting there, how did you make your choices? Because people can get stymied by choice.
You mean in the editing
room?
Yeah. Well, the funniest thing is because we had almost no money to shoot this movie, and because when we got into post-production, I had no time to edit it. Like, I literally had like 2 weeks to turn in my first cut, which was, after it screened for the producers, 80% of what you see in the movie is the first cut. I mean, it was literally, and I think for me, it helped that I didn't have a lot of takes to do on the set. And when I got in the editing room, the two or three takes that we had, it was easy to make my decisions. And then after we did our final first assemblage, then I could play with, you know, the wide shots and the close-ups and really find the nuances of the performances. But I think it helped because I saw the movie in my head prior to even filming mm-hmm. Principal Photography. And I think that was something that came to me in the writing process. So I just think all the steps informed the next to make it, you know, a little easier. I don't know if the word's easier, but a little more engaging.
Let's tell people what the movie's about while we're talking about it. Rodney Jones, you play Rodney Jones, a former boxing champ. He's working as a bouncer in a nightclub. He gets dragged into this revenge scheme of the Russian mob. This is dark. There is some darkness here, and I know you helped write it. Why was this a story you wanted to tell?
You know, it was. It's funny. It's like in the vein of a Crash or a Pulp Fiction. These are good people in an impoverished community who get caught up in this seedy incidents of this sex tape. Mm-hmm. And this Russian mob boss, played by Richard Dreyfuss, hires my character, who's an ex-professional boxer, to carry out this incident. And I think in this, you know, in this dark, seedy world, these characters find redemption and they realize that their life purpose is greater than what their actions are. Mm-hmm. And I just thought those themes were just fun to, I don't know, to go down the road with, you know.
Did you have to make any moral calls about what your characters would do as a director? Like your actor says, I think they would do this, but you as a director goes, oh no, they're this person.
Yeah. I give a speech to everybody who reads my screenplay. Or any work that I want to turn into a film, I say, this script is a 7. If you come to me with a 6, then we're going to go with the script. But if your idea is an 8 or a 9, it makes it in the movie. Because I believe that as a collaborative filmmaker, you encourage excellence from other people. And that was the environment. And shooting in New Orleans, I mean, that film community down there, they love cinema. They really do. And they work. That crew worked hard and crazy for us.
The city is as much a character in this film as anything else. How did you, as a director, get us to understand? I mean, there's certain cues about New Orleans, visual cues, but that's sort of like, I got that it was hot and sweaty and grimy.
Yeah, really hot. I mean, it was, you know, and we shot on an alligator farm for a day, and that was like the craziest experience I think I've ever had. But it was... It was, again, I got lucky to have a crew that was passionate to get the story told. So.
Now, what was something that you didn't understand about directing as an actor now that you understand now?
Yeah, that at the end of the day, everybody has questions for the director. And if you don't have answers, even if it's the wrong answer, you just have to have an answer for everybody on the set. And a director friend of mine told me, don't forget to sit down, because during the day, you'll get so caught up in running around that you never take a break to literally just sit down, you know?
And time to clear your brain.
Yeah.
Just kind of clear the palate.
Yeah.
What is something you learned as an actor, you know, now that you've been a director, that you might use as an actor next time you're on a film as the actor?
Well, as an actor director, the first day of filming, I found myself watching the actors while I was working with them in the scene. And then when I said cut the first time, I said, we got to go again, because I was more focused on their performance than I was staying in character.
Yep.
And I think it was a good lesson to say, focus on, you know, your character, and that'll help the actor more than anything else.
You mentioned listening and you mentioned answering questions. What are some other things that you took from other directors you've worked with that you threw into your toolkit?
You know, just encouraging input. You know, even my scriptee would say certain things to me about the scene that would engage me to question every little thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that act of discovery helps not only in your performance, but the look. You know, when you're collaborating with your DP and he's talking to you about
director of photography.
And he's talking about a certain lighting, or he's talking about the aspect of this shadowing on the set. All of these things, I think, inform a creative environment for the actors. Because at the end of the day, the actors tell the performers through their speech and look and all of that. So.
I didn't look at the cast list. I just wanted to watch the film before I looked at the cast list. I said, oh, there's Richard Dreyfuss. And then I couldn't place the woman in the film, and it's Famke Janssen in a completely different look and a completely different role.
Yeah.
How did these actors come to this project?
You know, you send them the script, and then you have a conversation with them, and you say, you know, I'm an actor too, and I know what it is to create a character that people that don't, aren't normally familiar with me playing. And Famke Janssen and Richard Dreyfuss both are playing roles that we're not used to seeing them play.
Not at all.
And I think that's what enticed them to come aboard.
Yeah, he's the mafia boss, the Russian mafia boss. Yeah. Did you speak, you said you mentioned you spoke with Denzel Washington. That's pretty cool. You can call up the pick up the phone. Hey, Denzel. It's Cuba. What other directors? Did you speak with any other directors?
I spoke to everybody that would talk to me. I mean, other actors. I mean, there was it was one of those things where I was so high anxiety ridden because the project came to me as a script that with another director attached.
Oh, interesting.
And I said yes to the project because of that director, not because of the screenplay. And then when he fell out, they offered me the role of as director. And I said, only if I can revisit the screenplay with the original writer, Eitan Goyen. And so we did. And so had that experience not happened to me, I don't know if I would have had the confidence to answer the questions on the set the way that we did, because we had a very limited time to shoot the movie. And I think it came together at the end.
How long you said it was?
Just a little less than 3 weeks to shoot the entire film, yeah.
That's fast, but in some ways that makes you have to make decisions.
Yeah, you got to make them, and quickly on the fly.
You don't have the luxury. But sometimes in that luxury of time, things can get sort of fuzzy and floppy and flabby, you know?
Well, I tell you, at the lunch break, I can't tell you how many times at my trailer door, it'd be the first AD, and he would say, okay, here's our shot list, and we only have 3 hours, what can we cut? And so I would have to visualize how I'd want the scene to be shot and then just start slashing my call sheet. And then we go out there. And then it was interesting because when I got into the editing room, it fell together as a puzzle because I didn't have the luxury of having all of the shots that I had envisioned in the screenplay. So we had to, the story told us itself, the story revealed itself in the editing room. So.
Well, your directorial debut is with Bayou Caviar, and you're going to be a director again of a thriller? Is that true? Is that what Variety reports? I just want to make sure what I read on the internet is true. Yeah. What's that project?
Yeah. Woody Pictures is just greenlit. This is an original screenplay that I wrote that, and we have a proper budget to do this one. And we're just in the early stages of pre-production on that now.
And I wondered if right now there's so many young, vibrant directors out there. Mm-hmm. Anyone particularly you admire that you think, wow, that's a young guy who's really got a vision?
There's been a couple of African-American directors of late that have really impressed me. The director of Moonlight.
Barry Jenkins.
Yeah, Barry Jenkins, of course. And Black Panther.
Ryan Coogler. This is our game. You say.
Yeah. And then, of course, I worked in Selma with Ava DuVernay. So there's a lot of cool voices coming out now.
We're speaking with Cuba Gooding Jr. about his directorial debut on Bayou Caviar. We also want to talk to him about heading back to Broadway. So stick around for that. Stay with us. All of it will be back after a quick break. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and we're back with my conversation with Cuba Gooding Jr. He co-wrote and stars in the film Bayou Caviar. It was also his directorial debut. And then on October 6th, he stepped into the role of Billy Flynn in Chicago on Broadway, and he'll wrap it up this coming Sunday, February 10th. In honor of that event, we're replaying my conversation with him. We talked last fall about how and why he stepped back into the role of Flynn after completing the role on London's West End. Take a listen.
You know, there's just something magical that happens when you connect with an audience. And, you know, I didn't know how hard it'd be to be singing and dancing 8 shows a week, 6 days a week. But it is addictive. And it's that physical, spiritual connection you get when you move that audience that certain way. And, they said, do you want to take it to Broadway? And I was like, of course. You know, we lost my father last year, who's the lead singer of The Main Ingredient.
Yeah.
And, coming back to his hometown, doing what he loved to do, it just feels right.
It felt like the circle.
Yeah, it felt like time. Yeah.
How do you balance what you want to bring to a performance? I saw an interview where you told someone, a London journalist, it's going to be the most soulful Billy Flynn you've ever seen, and he sort of chuckled. How do you balance that, what you want to bring, with the legacy of Chicago and Bob Fosse?
Yeah, well, it's like, if you think of Billy Flynn, and he's a criminal defense attorney in the 20s, well, he's probably not a black guy. So you balance it by bringing your energy and your personality to that role. You know, just like I think Hamilton did so beautifully with all that, the cast colorblind, but yet there's the essence of the words are still there. And it's how I saw Billy Flynn. You know, a lot of the dance numbers are, you know, Bob Fosse is very specific in his choreography. So there's a few little soulful moves that I add to that. But you still respect the simplicity of not just the choreography, but I mean the stage direction, the fact that they have the band on stage with you in that box playing behind you and that music kind of reverberating through you into the onto the audience. It's easy to be caught up in the feel that is the spirit of a play that's been running, a musical that was running 22 years, you know. So it's one of those things. And I thought that I would get tired of standing on in the wings hearing the songs, but all 158 shows, I never went to my dressing room. I stayed back there because it was literally like watching that orchestra perform during the show move me every time, every single performance.
You mentioned how grueling it can be. What do you do to take care of yourself and your voice and your body?
Yeah, sleep.
Sleep's number one?
The one day off, I slept, at one point, 17 hours. Holy like, God. Literally, I think it was because of the fact that I was jet-lagged and I was doing these intense workouts. But, sleep and, you know, drink a lot of throat coat tea and, you know.
Are you in rehearsals now?
Not yet. No,
okay.
I'll go a few days before I step on the stage the week of the 5th. So.
Now, you made your Broadway stage debut in 2013 in a production of Horton Foote's The Trip to Bountiful.
That's right.
What was the challenge of being on Broadway the first time? Was it the mental leap of this is Broadway?
There were a couple of challenges. One, to look across the stage and see Miss Cicely Tyson staring at you. Pretty intimidating. But, yeah, I think it was that whole thing of feeling that audience and the interaction of that audience the first time was intimidating. But then when you hear and you see and you feel that they get what you're doing and you get that emotional connection, especially with that play dealing with the loss and the grieving of a parent, that emotional release at the end of that play is something that I'll never forget, going into the green room and seeing Oprah Winfrey with tears around down her eyes on her arms stretched out wanting a hug. It's like, okay, I think we're doing something cool here, you know. So but it's I think it's why us film TV actors come back to the stage, because you miss that energy, that connection.
Yeah, and I also think that when people come to see a play, at least I know when I come to see a play, I'm there for the actors.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be connected to the actors through the play. I'm not having my arms crossed and like, I'm going to review this. It's like, no, wait, engage me. Get me in the story.
Yeah.
Make this something I can connect to.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you're talking about a Horton Foote play. You know, his writing is so beautifully expressive of the human condition that it's easy to get caught up in the words and feel that it's, you know, the play's talking directly to you and you're in whatever life situation you're dealing with.
I went to a screening of The People versus O.J. Simpson. I don't know how I got on this list, but I got invited to the fancy screening of the first one before the whole thing came out. Like, Nina Jacobson was there and Ryan Murphy was there. It was the whole big thing. And I remember after seeing it, I was like, what is this? It was so different than anything. And I think everybody who's seen the series knows this. It was so different than anything I'd seen in terms of a real person in a real complex situation being dramatized in a way that it felt new to me. Like, I felt like I know the story, but I don't know this story.
Right.
What did you think when you first read that script? Because that is a role that you this could go thumbs up or thumbs down.
That's
for an
right.
actor.
You have to trust the filmmaker. And Ryan Murphy, you know, when I met with him, I just felt like this guy really wanted to make a statement with this piece. And as you say, that first episode, that pilot episode, literally represented the birth of reality television in real time. And I just knew that with that and him at the helm, and then hearing of the casting of Sarah Paulson as Marcia Clark and Sterling K. Brown, but nobody knew. I didn't know who Sterling was, but I knew who Courtney B. Vance was. And I had seen him in his makeup tests. So I knew that these people were really going to, you know, bring truth to their roles. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the revelation that was Sterling K. Brown was just, you know, fun to watch unfold in real time.
Yeah, how he's blown up so much.
Oh, he's great.
Did you go back and rewatch any of the footage of that time, or did you just come to it fresh, like, this is a part I'm playing, I'm not even going to go to the history?
No, we had laptops in the courtroom in front of us watching the court tapes over and over again, mimicking little hand movements and gestures that they made. Yeah, every day of filming for 6 months.
What was a revelation about that time after you finished it that you really didn't understand, because we were all living through it?
You know, I was one of those young black actors living in Los Angeles at the time, had been exposed to police violence and harassment, and I said this in interviews, I didn't care if he did it or not at the time, I just didn't want him to be found guilty. Right. And having lived through that from the experience and having distance from that time and realizing that there were two families that were grieving the loss of their children, I felt an immediate guilt, you know, of even feeling that way. And it was just one of those things where, you know, and I hear other actors say, you know, this is a dark character that stuck with me. And I always thought that was kind of a hustle until I played this role and realized that it really does leave an imprint on your soul doing something as dark as that character was.
You recently told CBN News that you learned so much about African-American history through the work you've done. We mentioned the Tuskegee Airmen and the Butler.
Right.
Are there stories that you still want to tell that you know of African-American history you think would be great on the screen?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've been playing ice hockey for 25 years now, and a lot of people don't realize that the NHL was after the all Negro leagues in the Maritimes of 1800s in Canada with runaway slaves who actually played ice hockey in Nova Scotia. And there's a lot of documentation of how these slaves met with these Native Canadians, and they taught them their game, and they became, you know, hockey teams. And I thought that would be an interesting story to tell, but there's a lot of stories like that.
Yeah. Is there anything that you really want to do that you haven't done yet? I mean, we've talked about Broadway, we've talked about directing, we've talked about screenwriting. What's the next box you want to check?
You know, I'm good. I'm good right now with what I got ahead of me. I'm good. I'm going to focus on this directing thing for a minute and
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.